everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life. Life also, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across the genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we're funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can learn more about the PNWA by going to pnwa.org. I will be teaching a class at the PNWA in marketing for authors who hate to market. If you think you're one of those, and if you'd like a little help in that area, well, I suggest you sign up. I think it is going to be in November sometime. It shows you how dialed in I am here. Yes, it's going to be in November, late October. Check it out. Go to pnwa.org and you can sign up for it there. Sign up for it there. All right. Enough of that. Enough about me. I like to get in, well, just a little bit more about me. I like to get in on a thing early. I do. I don't like to wait in line. I like to be the first one there. I don't like hunting for parking spots. I like to get in on things early, which is why I am glad I got to interview today's guest, the wonderful A.C. Fuller. You may or may not have heard of A.C., but if you like smart, intelligent, crisply written suspense novels, I think you will. His first novel, The Anonymous Source, is just out by Booktrope, and it is all those things. And it's surprising, and it is taught, and it is, well, I think there's going to be a lot more good coming from this fellow. He's also, I should say, AC is also the host of a wonderful podcast, Writer 2.0. So if you're listening to this, you like listening to writers talk about writing, I highly recommend checking out Writer 2.0. And he's also been a chef, a journalist, and an adjunct professor of journalism at NYU, but he lives here in the Northwest now and teaches writing and literature at Northwest Indian College. And he's here to talk to me about any old thing we want to. AC, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan of the show, of the newsletter you send out, and of everything you do. So it's great to be here.
Oh, well, thank you, AC. It's good to have you on. I'm curious. You and I know each other a little bit, and yeah. I'm familiar with your work. But what I do not know, when did you first realize that you were interested in stories? That stories, just stories in general, meant something to you?
Boy, that's a good question. That stories in general, that's a little different than what I usually hear, which is kind of when did you think you wanted to be a writer? But stories in general. Let's see. I think it was, you know, I think I was a little bit of a late bloomer on this. I mean, I read books. Yeah. I had books that were really important to me. I was a big fan of the Great Brain series when I was 8, 9, 10. I don't think people read those anymore, but they were very important to me. When I was about 12 or 13, I was in that kind of awkward stage, and I had a really good friend who was, you know, he was kind of a jerk to most people, but we got along well. And I was walking along with him one day, and I noticed I was kind of telling the story of what he and I were doing in my head. I was kind of writing it out in my head, looking at it from kind of outside myself and thinking, well, what is the story of this and why is that important to me? It's kind of getting some distance from it. And that was when I first really started thinking about writing seriously. Story, I don't know. You know, I remember there's some kids' books that really – altered me, like Benjamin and his 365 birthdays. I loved that story. I read it over and over again. And The Wizard of Oz, I remember that story and being able to sense, even when I was 6 or 7, that it had kind of deeper themes at work than are immediately clear if you're a kid. But kind of knowing there's something deeper going on there. So that was another one where I was like, oh, you know, this story is not just something to divert us or entertain us, but also something that can teach us something about being a person when it's at its best, I think.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I was just thinking about AC is, you know, I go and I give talks now to writers usually. And what I do is I usually tell stories about myself. You know, I get up there and I tell, this happened to me and that happened to me. But when I meet people afterwards, and if they've liked it, they always want to, you know, certain people want to tell you if they liked it. It's sort of the thing people do. But after they thank you or me, the next thing they do is tell me a story about themselves. That's the next thing that comes out. And I think there's something about that in story, doesn't it? I mean, doesn't some – I mean, so if you read – like I remember reading Lord of the Rings. Did you read any of Tolkien when you were a kid?
Yeah, that was actually one I was going to name. I read The Hobbit first when I was about 11. And that's one of the first kind of more – slightly more serious books I read all the way through that I wasn't assigned for some reason. That actually kind of spurred my interest in reading when I was 11, 12, 13. And I didn't read all of Lord of the Rings. I think I read the first, you know, 1,000 pages or so.
Just the first. Yeah, you know what? I took a look at that the other day because my son, my older son had read them. And I was like, and I read those when I was 13 or 12 or 13. And I can't believe I read those. They are so dense. It is.
Yeah.
I mean, it is not written like a fantasy novel is written in now, for instance.
No, and I think this is probably sacrilegious, but I think they were too dense for me. I lost interest in them. When I was 12 or 13, after reading The Hobbit, and I actually just went back and reread The Hobbit, and I've never made it all the way through the whole Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Oh boy.
Which I'm a little embarrassed about.
No, it's okay. It's okay. Stories, you know, I love listening to you describe your interest in your Wizard of Oz and talking about the deeper, sort of the deeper meaning there, because I do think that when a story connects us, I feel like they take us into some part of ourselves, regardless of what the, I mean, because you're not a girl in Kansas, you know, but her tale becomes your tale, or else it wouldn't mean anything to you.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And
it wouldn't mean anything to you.
It's great. Something like that, where it can work on so many different levels, that story. The Wizard of Oz. I think there's a reason it's so popular, and the movie's so popular. It has been for, I don't know what, 90 years or something now.
Yeah.
Because it's just, you know, it's a tale of a girl trying to get home, but it's with this, when you throw the side characters in and their lack of brains and courage, it's evoking some much deeper things and kind of the possibility of finding ourselves in new ways, I think.
You know, so you mentioned the question you usually get asked is, you know, when did you decide you wanted to write? I assume at some point you wrote something in school and you were perhaps singled out as being maybe just a little bit better at it than some of the other kids. Is that part of the story?
That exact thing happened. Yeah. I can actually remember. Yeah. I can remember when it was exactly. I was 15 and I was in Ingrid's European literature class, I think. And our teacher was actually a romance novelist. And
really?
I still don't know the name that she published under. She published under a pen name, and she would never tell us. But I was able to find out. She was actually, you know, she had 10 or 20 books out. This was the mid-90s. And was probably not making a huge living off of it, but she was publishing and selling some books. And she singled me out for just some essay I wrote or something on, who knows, I don't even remember the name of the book we were reading that quarter, but she singled me out and said, this is college level writing. And of course that, you know, stroked my ego a little bit. And what was interesting is I grew up in a family of people who were writing, and with a brilliant brother, mom, and dad who were all writing. And I always felt like I would be the last one to ever write anything. And it wasn't my strong suit. It was their strong suits. And I was better at sports and things like that. So it came a little later for me, but the external feedback actually did push me along a little bit.
Now, I call this author to author, and if people have ever listened to me, I don't think I've gone into it too deeply on this show, but there's a reason I choose that it's called author to author, because I think it's one thing to write, but it's another thing to say I want to share it with other people. You know, my ambition is to write so that other people can read this story and I can share what I think is important with it with them. And I think that most of the challenges the people who call themselves writers face have to do with the fact that they know someone else is going to read it and someone else needs to like it in order for it to thrive in the world. And so when you say your brother, your brilliant older brother, and your mom and your dad were writing, were they trying to publish things, or were they just people who loved to write? What do you mean by that?
Let's see. My mom was a poet. She was not trying to publish things very often. She had a few things published kind of here and there in newspapers. My dad was writing nonfiction, and he was trying through my teens and teenage years to get published, and eventually did, mm-hmm. and has 3 or 4 nonfiction books out and now a novel out, and was writing articles and things like that.
Oh, wow.
My brother.
Okay.
He was very serious. He was a 9-to-5 writer all day, every day, incredibly
wow.
focused and persistent on doing that. My brother was only 2 years older, but he was, writing brilliant short stories when he was 9 and 10, much more verbal than I was.
Right.
And he was, I think he sold his first story to a comic book called Bloodthirsty Pirate Tales when he was 14 or 15.
Wow.
Probably most people have not heard of that. It's not a huge Marvel comic or anything, but he was actually selling stuff when he was a teenager.
Wow.
And creating comic books, creating science fiction. He wrote screenplays. I mean, he was prolific, but was not, he doesn't have a novel out yet. He will at some point. But he ran into some more of the difficulties, I think, that you've talked about on your show and we've talked about together in the past, of the kind of psychological difficulties that come with putting yourself out there that are different mm-hmm. than just being a brilliant writer, which he is. There's some more difficulties that can come along with the process.
Yeah, that's they are. That's why the show exists for the
yes.
most part, because I really think that those are most of what people have to overcome. To have a career as a writer of some kind. That's
yes.
been my experience anyway.
That's why I love the intro to your show, that you have to write the book you want to write, you have to become the person you want to become. I'm getting it wrong, but it's something like that.
It's that what it takes to write the book you want to write is what it takes to lead the life you want to lead.
Yes. And
I really mean
that.
That's
so true. Oh, yeah.
It's
it describes my experience, exactly of how I went from... Well, because I got fairly serious about writing in my early 20s, but I also had a young child, I was married, I was working, and I was struggling with not being kind of a developed, grown-up person yet, which most people
right.
in their early
yeah.
20s aren't. And I would say I'm only
sure.
approaching that now in my mid-30s. But the
right.
A lot of people, it's not like I couldn't put sentences together, it's that I kept
yeah.
self-sabotaging or getting distracted or setting my writing aside because of reason X, Y, or Z, or self-doubt. So it was all these things that were keeping me from doing it, or that I was doing that was keeping me from doing it. So then only really in my mid-30s did I get really serious about writing books and publishing books, even though I'd been writing the whole time. I'd never really finished anything. And it really took kind of developing as a person, growing up and maturing and having a stable family life and a stable job, things like that. Only then could I really get serious about writing actual books that I wanted to go into the world. So it's just like how you describe it.
And if you were writing you know why I describe it that way, actually, in part what you're talking about, which is, you self-sabotage, you put it aside and so on, because unlike, in your early 20s, when you're trying to make your way in the world, say you get a job, if you have the job, even though you could walk out of it at any time, the fact that people are there waiting for you and you have a time card to punch and all these external expectations, it's for most people, it's easy to keep that commitment. But for writing, the only one you're committing to is yourself. There's no, Dennis Lehane said to me when I interviewed him, it was great. He was sitting down to write his book and he said he kept a card over his computer when he wrote that said, "Nobody cares." And what he meant is nobody actually cared whether he failed or succeeded. It was nobody's business. And it was you could look at it self-pityingly, but for him, it was sort of a Zen thing. Nobody cared. It was just up to him. Just up to him.
You know what that evokes for me also is there's a certain freedom that comes with that. If you're sitting in front of the computer or the typewriter or a blank sheet of paper, if nobody cares, it gives you – they don't care – there's a negative connotation to that, but the positive is that you don't have to censor yourself. You're free
That's
to
right.
write what you want if no one cares, and you can really write honestly from that perspective.
That's right. And but I've heard both the two that are coming to mind first are Andre Dubuce, who talked at the who gave a great keynote at the last PNWA conference, and yes. also Amy Tan, when I interviewed her, both talked about having to contend with the bright light of success, that once you've published books and maybe you've gained a lot of attention, now you've got to sink into that same disregard for other people with all this expectation on you. Maybe you've been given a lot of money. You know it's going to be reviewed in the New York Times, on and on and on. And so one way or another, you've got to keep returning, AC. So you've written your first book, and now you're going to have to keep finding that same place of freedom every time you write, even as the attention towards your work grows, which I'm sure it will.
Yeah, you know what? On a much, much, much smaller scale than Amy Tan, I'm already experiencing that.
Yeah, you see?
My book it's a sequel, so some of the characters are continuing. And even though the book doesn't have anywhere near that kind of success at this point, I am hearing from random readers from random places around the world saying, oh, I love this character. I hope this person will end up with this person.
Yeah.
I hope that we'll learn about this in the sequel or that in the sequel. And honestly, I'm finding it difficult psychologically to deal with it, just because I'm trying to really focus and do exactly what we're talking about, which is get back, you know, into myself and tune out the noise and write my, you know, 5,000 words a week or whatever my target is to kind of get this
right.
book moving along. And I'm struggling with adjusting to the noise, even though, you know, the noise is relatively small compared to, say, someone like Amy Tan. It still is affecting. It's amazing.
I don't think it matters. I think any noise at all it takes is one person. All it takes
right.
is one person, and you can and you see what's happening already. Don't you sense? I go through this with people who read my work and talk to me about it. And because I write inspirational stuff, they tend to be pretty appreciative, you know, because they're not generally going to tell me if they think it sucks. Occasionally
right.
they do, but mostly they're appreciative. But even when they're appreciative, there's a sense of like what they read and what I wrote are slightly different, or at least. Yeah, that they've really so made it their own that once you start hearing for the readership, you begin to learn just how little control you have over that, what actually happens when the thing is published, how little that story belongs to you, really.
Yes.
At least that was my experience of it.
I am finding that, and I'm a bit of a control freak, and when it comes to certain things, and I'm definitely someone who, if I didn't have a time when I had to let the book go, I would have just kept editing it and trying to refine it
yeah.
and make it better and better and better and never put it out. So I sort of had to say, okay, this is my deadline. I'm working on it till then, and then it's done. And I knew it was close. I just would have kept going. But that's exactly what I've been finding, is that people are having responses to it that are, A, they're wildly different from each other. So three different people
yep.
will give me three sets of feedback they just highlight really different things. Some people are interested in the romance in the book, or some people are interested just in that it, you know, talks about how the media works, and there's
yeah.
a slight 9/11 angle just as a backdrop.
Yeah.
It's not about 9/11. Some people are really focused on that, and it has very little to do with my experience of the book. It's
That's
really
right.
their experience of it, and learning that is strange for sure. I know you already
it
know
is.
That, and most of the authors, but it's a strange thing to learn, just that their experiences of it. Really don't have much to do with my intention or my experience of writing it.
None whatsoever. You just have to give it away. It's weird, but you know, and I'll tell you, every time I write something, I still harbor the illusion that I am delivering an experience to everybody. I mean,
mm-hmm.
pretty much, and it never is the case. It never ever is the case. I don't know if I told you the story about Jan Martel, who wrote Life of Pi. Are you
no.
familiar with that book? Well, Life
I'm
of Pi, they made
the
it
book,
to the movie.
Not the story.
All right, well, so, you know, the Life of Pi, the book, I mean, there was the movie eventually, but the book went crazy. I mean, it was, what he described it as, it went global, you know. And and it won the Man Booker Prize. I mean, it's the complete writer experience. Everything the writer fantasizes about, he had that
right.
level of, you know. So I was like, what's it like? You know, what's that like? Just go ahead and tell us, will you? And he's like, you know, it's weird. It's not me they love, it's the book. He said, but I loved meeting people. And he met this woman who said, "Thank you, Mr. Martell. I love this book. Thank you for writing such a great book about merit." And he said, "What?" And she said, "Yeah." Oh, she said, he said, "It's a great book about marriage." And he said, "Oh, I was not writing a book about marriage. I was writing a book." And then she cut him off and she said, "I have been married, and that tiger is marriage. That book is about marriage." And so, and he said, then the book was about marriage as far as she was concerned. He never would have in a million years dreamed that that was what it was about. But that was her experience. And so that was the end of it.
Right.
The boy in the boat was with me. And that was, and that's the end of it. And I think that that's the perfect example. It's part of the reason why, I don't know, but well, you taught literature, but why interpreting literature can get a little slippery, I think.
Yeah. And that's why when I do teach literature, I teach, the only literature class I teach now is Survey of Native Literature. So it's only literature written by Native Americans at a small college I teach at now. And yeah, and that's actually doubly tricky since I'm not Native American and all my students are. And so I try not to really teach literature exactly. I would consider myself more of a coordinator where I pick out what we're going to read from a vast pile of stuff and I encourage them to do it and I come up with assignments and I read it and I find nice interviews with the authors. And I really open it up for discussion to see how it hits them. And it is amazing, especially when we're reading poetry, how differently the same poem will hit a room of 10 different people. And their experiences of it will have nothing to do with each other or mine.
Yeah.
I try not to interpret it too much for them, but just to kind of lay it out and then see what happens, you know, see what kind of magic happens.
I think it's the only way to really do it, honestly, because everyone's experience is so intimate of the piece. You know, all your readers are having such a personal, intimate experience of the piece as they fill in all the details you didn't give them with their own imagination. It becomes their own book.
Right. And that's even doubly true for me because I tend to write very, as you said, kind of sparsely. So there's lots of details that are left out on purpose. And I hope that triggers people's imagination to fill them in. But it definitely is the case that people are having to fill in all sorts of things. And I've heard some interesting interpretations so far of the book. And it kind of scares the hell out of me to open my email box these days or check my Facebook page just to see what, you know, things have been very positive, which is great. But just even for me, you know, a positive kind of comment can sidetrack me just as much as a negative one in terms of the work done that I need to get done.
Yeah. When you sit down, AC, you got to sit down and forget other people exist. You got to forget anyone's ever going to read it. You really do. You really don't have a choice. You know, it's an illusion, but that's what you got to do if you're going to get lost in the story.
Right. And that's what I'm working hard on doing. And I find it easier to do that in the morning. So I try to write in the morning before anyone wakes up when I'm just kind of by myself and in my own experience. And that usually works better. Once I've gone into the day, I find it harder to shield that stuff from my mind.
Yes, you know why? See, when you're in the day, you're caught up in the business of the world, you know, and that place you go to write, that sort of dreamlike state you have to enter where you forget is totally different than the world that you're managing with your kids and your money and your teaching. And it's a totally different energetic place. And it's and the closest state to it is a dream. So it's best to do it right when you wake up. I think that's certainly true for me. Is the shortest distance to go psychically to travel to get to where the writing happens.
Right. Yeah, that's a great way of putting it because I do write during the day sometimes and I can if I have to, but it's the shortest distance. And the most, really, for me, it's about efficiency. You know, if I want to write, you know, 1,000 new words on my story that day, it literally will take me, you know, half the time if I do it in the morning than if I do it at night or in the afternoon. So it's just more efficient to do it that way. And I think the writing's probably better because it's a little more in that kind of dreamlike state.
Well, you've got to forget about the world you live in. I know it sounds weird, but I mean, even though you're writing about, you don't write about, fantastic lands or science fiction. You're writing about this world, but you actually have to forget about the world that A.C. Fuller lives in to enter this other world. You've got to forget about it.
It's really true. I found for this book, even though it's set, you know, in 2001, 2002, that world is really a historical world at this point because of the way technology has changed so much in the last 15 years. And I have to enter into that world. How did people relate to information and communications? It was totally different in 2002 than people today relate to information and communications because there wasn't smartphones and Facebook and Google was just starting and the internet still sucked and a lot of people didn't have it. And so I really do have to enter into an alternate reality wherein all of these changes have not happened and the way people think and act is very different.
Well, and not only that, but those people you're talking about aren't in the room with you. They only exist in one place. That's underneath AC's cranium, you know? And so it's really it's all just make-believe. Even when I write memoir, which is what I write for the most part, I'm still writing about something other than what is happening. I mean, there's a thing, AC, our job is to believe in what does not exist. That's what we're paid to do.
Yeah.
What doesn't actually exist at this moment.
Yeah. So I find it easier to enter into the characters than I find it to enter into an alternate sort of physical reality or technological reality. It's probably why I don't write fantasy. Whenever I interview fantasy authors, I always ask them about world creation because it's something that's really foreign to me, probably because of my journalism background. I'm into accuracy and research and things like that. But, I find inhabiting the characters is even easier than inhabiting an alternate historical reality like 2002 looks from our vantage point now.
Well, AC, I know that you have you've got promises to keep here, and I don't want to keep you too long. But before I let you go, I want you to answer one more question for me. You probably haven't heard me ask this before.
Yep.
Maybe you've prepared your answer. But if writing has taught you anything, it's taught you what?
Boy, you think I would have prepared an answer for this, but I never really do that kind of thing. I would say it's taught me it's going to sound like I'm buttering you up because it's really the same lesson that we talked about earlier, that the reason that I quit so many times on multiple screenplays, multiple novels, multiple short stories through my 20s was that I hadn't yet grown up and matured to the point where it was worth the effort to say any of the things I was trying to say. Like they were partial thoughts, unfinished thoughts, unfinished work. So it's really taught me that it goes hand in hand with being an adult, with growing up emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, to the extent that whatever wants to be said through me will come out. And that all of these sort of quote-unquote failures I had before that with writing really were meant to be, in the sense that they were just helping me to grow up. And I think even with finishing this book and getting it out, it's a similar process. You know, it's more of a success than a failure, but it's just kind of helping me to grow up into the next place to write the next book. And I hope it will continue like that for the next few books.
If you can hold on to that attitude, it will. It absolutely will. That is a great attitude. Let each thing, each rejection, each acceptance, each good review, each bad review, let all of it help you, because that's what it's there to do. I really believe, AC, that life just wants to help you. That's all it wants to do. And if you can hold that attitude, you stand the best chance to be helped the most. So good luck with the anonymous source and all that's to come. You've got the next one cranking away, I assume.
I do. It's cranking away. And I just want to point out what you just said is very similar to a quote I gave on my own podcast this morning, because it's the birthday today of the poet Rumi. And he has a famous quote that what you seek is seeking you. And it's very similar to what you just said. So I thought I'd bring that up because it is Rumi's birthday today.
Oh, happy birthday, Rumi.
He would be about 908 years old if he were still with us.
Okay. Well, so, and looking spry, I'm sure. I'm in good company. Well, AC, it's been great talking to you. Check out his Writer 2.0 podcast. We didn't get to talk about that, but it's awesome. Check out The Anonymous Source. And good luck, AC, and I hope I get to talk to you when the next one comes out.
Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye. Take it easy. Yes, whatever. Oh, I love that. Whatever you're seeking is seeking you. It's, oh God, is it ever true? It's chasing you. Well, all right. Next week, I'll be here at Tuesday, my normal time, talking to Anna Leffler, the debut novelist, another debut novelist. Until then, go let what is looking for you come to you, because it's out there. Coming and a coming and a coming.